Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
Hello, it's January 15th, 2017, and welcome to episode 145 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, I'm your host, Ken Gagne, and joining me today is the Dread Pirate Carrington, scourge of college campuses everywhere.
I went through a college campus once in the back of a Black Mariah. I like that you said hello. That's very nice. You're very pleasant.
Hello, Carrington.
Hello. I meant hello at the very beginning. I thought that was a nice change to our intro.
Well,
hello, Ken.
Well, I also want to wish everybody a happy new year. Happy 2017. I hope that 2017 is less of a trash fire than 2016 was.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, we'll see. It's too soon to tell.
No, not really.
Also joining us on RCR today is that fellow Boston retro computing enthusiast who likes to tell the ladies he's a master of tongues, the linguistics professor Paul Hagstrom.
Oh my god.
Hello.
Hello, Paul. How are you today?
I was better a minute ago. But
this is what
I'm
happens
fine.
When at the very last minute you tell me to host and improvise.
Yep, all is well. There's no snow. I spent New Year's actually up in Montreal where it is all snow, but there's nothing here. I don't know. It's supposed to be winter. It's January. Anyway.
It is quite variable. It's been up to the 60s and now it's below freezing again. Who knows? And finally, joining us on today's show is the gentleman without whose initials we would never have had the poet E.E. Cummings, Mr. Earl Evans.
Hey, hey.
Hey, hey, Earl.
And I will join the crowd in wishing everyone a happy and prosperous 2017. And speaking of snow, snowpocalypse here in Portland. If you follow my tweetable tweeting tweets, you'll see that my city got buried, and then it dropped below freezing and didn't go above. So basically, we've been stuck for about the last 5 days, but it looks like tomorrow it rains and goes into the 40s, and that's your weather report from the left coast.
Well, there are worse places to be snowbound than Portland, Oregon.
Indeed. The trees are pretty. I took lots of pictures.
And where can we find those? Do you have a Flickr account?
I don't, but I should. So let me do that. Let me go ahead and expand my social media portfolio. Just because you told me to, Ken.
Excellent. For all the RCR listeners who don't stalk Earl enough, watch for that link in the show notes. So let's see. I believe we start with the host topic. Is that correct? I haven't been on this show in the last quarter. This is my quarterly appearance. Is that what we do next?
Mm-hmm. We do.
Excellent. Well, in that case, the host topic this week is one that is near and dear to my heart. If you ever go to Kansas Fest and I'm giving a talk, chances are it's about games. If you ever listen to RCR and I'm on the show, chances are I'm talking about games. If I'm booting up my Apple II, chances are it's to play games. But there's more to it than just the software, or even the hardware in the sense of what platform you're playing it on, whether you're playing on an original Apple II or emulated or via a website like Virtual Apple. There's also the question of what is the input device you're going to use. A lot of games ask, do you want to use keyboard or joystick, keyboard or paddles? And answering that with anything other than keyboard requires that you have those options available to you, which can be challenging if you're playing on an emulator and don't know what device to hook up or how to get the drivers to set up. But nonetheless, many of us grew up playing games on the original Apple, and we probably have hardware from back then that we remember fondly, even if it may not work today. So my question to today's guest is, whatever device you're playing on, whether it is browser, emulator, original Apple II, or old computer, TRS-80, Commodore 64, whatever your machine might be, what is your favorite retro gaming input device? Whether you want to go broadly by saying keyboard or joystick, or you want to use a specific brand or model. Let's start with Carrington.
Let's start with Carrington. I'm going to go with an opening statement that I have pretty much hated every joystick always. at least from an Apple II standpoint. My retro computing platform of choice is, of course, the Apple II. I have not hidden that fact from our listeners. But I have never been happy with the joysticks. Back in the day as a kid, and still currently, my joystick of choice for the Apple II, if I'm on real hardware, is a I think it's called the Mach 3. So it's a fairly straightforward two-button Apple joystick. It is as bad as most of them. It's got an uncomfortable joystick stick itself with an almost unusable button on the top, but it has adjustable pots, which is pretty necessary for the flakiness that is Apple II gaming. So it is all just it's about picking how little disappointment I can find in a given joystick. So when it comes to the Apple II, the Mach 3 is my choice. In general, I prefer game pads to joysticks, so I will often use an adapter that will just let me use a modern game pad, even on old hardware, which I find a more comfortable gaming experience. But when I go full retro, my choice will be the CH Products Mach 3. If we're talking about retro gaming as a larger category, then I think I'm going to select an Atari cabinet joystick, specifically from 1973's remarkably offensive flop Gotcha, where some internally in Atari there was a joke about how joysticks are all very phallic, so why don't they make a female-oriented game? To them, a female-oriented game was one basically about sexual assault, and they decided that instead of joysticks, it would be two squeezable pink rubber mounds. Yep. So they put two breasts on the front of the Gotcha cabinet. I am not making this up. And you control your character in this incredibly offensive maze game by squeezing a pair of phony breasts. So, you know, things could be worse. I'm going to stick with the CH Products Mach 3. There you go. There's my answer.
What a
we'll put a link in the show notes for those who don't think or who think I just made that product up. Oh, no, Atari, that one's on you.
Well, thank you for that hate-filled answer, Carrington, and Happy New Year to you as well. I'm so glad our first episode of 2017 is off to such a loving start. What about Earl? Earl, tell me about your favorite retro gaming input device.
Sure. Well, first off, I'm recovering from fear that we're going to lose our G rating on the show, but
if I have anything to do with it.
G for Gotcha?
Yeah, exactly. So let's look at it this way. There, like you mentioned, there's a variety of input devices. Of all of those, I do tend to prefer the joystick. And I'll also say there are two flavors that you're going to find out there in the vintage computer world. You'll find analog from such players as Apple and IBM, where you have a smooth, continuous movement on your X and Y axes. Or if you're talking Atari, Commodore, and a variety of other systems, you have a digital joystick, which is just a switch. You get no kind of granularity there. It's just either on or off. But strangely, those are the kind that I like. Although the Atari joystick I always found to just be too squishy, and it will break after a while. So I like that style of joystick, but I didn't like Atari's particular choice. So back in my retail days, I discovered one of the joysticks we sold was from a company called Suncom, and again, contributing to maybe us losing our rating, it was called the Slick Stick, which, yes, as you can imagine, got lots of gray area comments from our customers, but they did like them because it had a really solid feel, whereas the Atari felt plasticky, rubbery, kind of squishy. This had a very commanding kind of clunk feel. when you were going between the axes. And so when you're playing the game, you didn't have to guess, did I actually make that move or didn't I? And it just, it felt more solid and robust too. And I'm kind of hard on joysticks. I don't know about you guys, but when I'm playing the game, I'm really into it. I'm like, bam, bam, bam. And so I just go through Atari joysticks like crazy, but not these Suncom models. So that is my favorite because it's solid, because it's the Atari style, not the Apple IBM style. And that's my opinion. You're stuck with it.
That sounds like a great answer. Thank you for sharing, Earl. And Paul, tell us about yours.
Yeah, well, I was also going to say that, I mean, so first of all, there's the joystick that I am particularly most fond of is the one, of course, that I used growing up. So it was a TG joystick, so it was sort of a, it was kind of like a rectangle. And the joystick itself was actually a little bit small compared to most others, you know, so it had two buttons on the left, red buttons on a kind of a beige rectangle, and then a little black, I don't know what it was, probably maybe an inch and a half or something long joystick itself. And I kind of liked that because it was sort of, you didn't have to move a lot in order to make it do its thing. I know I was going to also put in here that I really do not like the Atari joysticks either. They do feel, I guess that's true, it's squishy somehow, but they're not fun to use. I very much don't like the Intellivision controllers. I don't know if, I think it was Intellivision that had this dumb little disc things. But I think if I had a choice, usually, when the game was to be played, my favorite retro gaming input device was the keyboard. I always felt like I had a lot more control over it on the keyboard than on the joystick. And technically speaking, I guess in the Apple, that might not even really be true in a sense, because the Apple can only detect the last key that you hit, like one key at a time. So sometimes you would get messed up because you can't hit two keys at once and have them both be detected. One's going to be detected and the other is not. But I still felt like just much more in control using, you know, AZ and the arrows or whatever. So that's my pick, actually, the keyboard with the TG joystick in second.
Good pick. And what about you, Ken?
What about me? People have been asking that for years. My favorite joystick was the, I don't know the model or brand, it's just the Apple IIe joystick, the completely gray one. Anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like Paul, it's the one that I grew up with. So it's the one that I'm most familiar with. It's the one that I played Wolfenstein and Choplifter and Lode Runner on. And, yep, I do have the box pulled up. It just is called Apple Joystick 2E and 2C. It's from Apple. That is the brand. And I'm sure that there are better ones out there, but I just liked this one. The way it's oriented, you move the joystick with the right and push the buttons on the left, which is just the opposite of gamepads that we use nowadays. But I think back then, the configuration that Apple presented us with was the standard. That I don't know if that favors lefties or if they just figured right-hand people want to move the joystick with the right hand. I don't know. Even now, when I go to arcades, I'm so confused by games that have the joystick right in the middle and identical sets of buttons on either side, so you can be left or right-handed. I never know which way I'm supposed to play because I feel like I grew up playing one way and now all the controllers are a different way. And I'm not sure which is the standard. But I liked the Apple IIe joystick. I liked the well that the joystick sits in, even though the joystick itself seems kind of thin and flimsy. I liked that you could bang it around in that well, kind of like Earl when you're just responding very rapidly to an action game. And it just had a good feel to it. I still have mine somewhere around here, and I'm very happy to be using it when I'm playing on the original Apple II. I haven't figured out a great analog for when I'm emulating an Apple II, and in those cases, I do use the keyboard like Paul does, but it's not really my favorite because a lot of games back then didn't really have a standard for which letters did what. It wasn't like the WASD configuration that we use with a lot of first-person shooters nowadays, not always. And so I'm always sort of trying to remember where to leave my hand and what keys to rest on when playing different games, because it moves from game to game. But I guess that's true nowadays anyway. Anyway, great. Thank you all so much for sharing your favorite retro gaming input device. Why don't we move ahead to listener feedback?
So I can maybe take over here quickly. We had a few things that came in. So Teza wrote to just sort of relate a story. He was sort of cleaning out his book collection and just sort of checking on Amazon to see what these, you know, like whether they should save them, try to get them to people. And he discovered he had a book called Easy Interfacing Projects for the Commodore 64 by Jim Downway et al. And he went onto Amazon and discovered that it was being sold for thousands of dollars. And he thought, that can't be right. the PDFs are available. What is happening? And he checked a couple of the different, you know, the different book sites, and they all seem to have these very high prices. And he's guessing that it might have been little pricing bots, you know, fighting against each other, leading to this kind of result. But he was wondering, he was just sort of relating the story and wondering if other people have had this experience. When I've gone on eBay and looked, you know, I've seen a book that seemed interesting, I will sometimes go and look on Amazon or, you know, Abbey Books or whatever it is called, and just see if it's cheaper. And usually you can see like some special collector's one that's, you know, hundreds or thousands, and then, you know, the rest are like 9 cents. But
I saw this a couple different times, and in one of the cases it was actually for a piece of software. One of the packages I'd been after forever was a DBase compiler called Clipper and a specific version, Summer 87. And it came up somehow as selling for $1,500. And I thought, that's nuts. Nobody's going to pay that kind of money for that. What happened? And now, in retrospect, I think Teza's got the right idea that these things just get into automated bidding wars with each other or something, and something that's moderately rare, all of a sudden these bots, you know, and I think people fear this happening with the stock market too, right? All the automated trading, it just sends something up into the stratosphere in error, and nobody's ever going to buy it for that. But
you think the bots would be set to try to underbid each other so you could sell? I don't understand the world. I have encountered this, though, as well, with a number of times looking for books, looking especially like old programming manuals and such. And frequently there will be, you know, 6 copies available for sale in various locations, 4 of which want hundreds of dollars and 2 of which are, you know, $3.95 and free shipping. It's crazy. So unsurprisingly, I just always buy the cheap one.
Mm-hmm. With those, it's almost always, you know, some kind of like boilerplate listing that says there may be some, you know, highlighting or writing or dings on the cover or whatever, and you never really know, you don't know what shape it's going to be in. But so let's see. Mark wrote in about the TI-99-4 eBay pick from episode 143. So he said he, you know, had watches the TI related auctions and actually saw that come up just as a $20 buy it now TI-99-4A, but then when we picked it, that was on a relist. So apparently he's guessing that the original seller realized the error and canceled it and relisted it. Apparently it eventually sold for $135. So yeah, too bad he didn't jump in on that $20 buy it now. But he also wanted to mention that he has his own podcast, which I think we can mention here, Tube Tunes, the television theme music podcast. I have not listened to it, but I have opened the webpage and it looks interesting enough to sample, at least. So thanks, Mark, for pointing us to that and writing in. Tony wrote to remind us that the Computer History Museum released the source code for Word for Windows 1.1a. This was a while ago. I forget now how long ago, years ago, though. But it wasn't in my consciousness, so I thought it was kind of interesting, worth reminding people to go look at the source code releases that the Computer History Museum has been responsible for. A couple of things on Facebook came in. Douglas on Facebook wrote to ask whether anyone else is the owner of a Z80 membership card and posted a picture of his. Do any of you have one?
I do not.
I don't, but they sure look neat. Mm-hmm. They're small and inexpensive, and I think a great little thing. Wish I did have one.
Yeah, it seems like it's a kind of a doable little project. You know, it's not a single board computer, I don't think, but it's not very many board computer that fits in something sort of Altoid sized. And then Ricky on Facebook says, "Hello from Glasgow, Scotland." and started with a borrowed ZX81, ZX81 probably. And so, hello, Ricky. thanks for joining the Facebook group. And that will do it for the feedback. So back to you, Ken.
Great. Thank you, Paul. We really should just say that you're the co-host. Come on, Paul. You can do it.
I'm the co-host.
There you go. Thanks, buddy.
All right.
All right. Now let's get into the news. News of items and interest and all their sorts of goodies that have happened since the last time we spoke, or just things we haven't had the opportunity to speak about first. Carrington, tell us what's going on in Norway.
It's cold.
What
else is going on in Norway? Very high standard of living, happy people, and it's very cold. Oh, but they're also shutting off FM radio. Goodbye, FM radio. So looks like it's a complete switch in the country over to DAB, digital audio broadcasting. A bunch of countries in Europe say they're going to watch this to see if it's something they might want to try. I think it's a complicated issue, so I don't know if I am in favor or not in favor of this. And it's not exactly a retro computing topic, but I do think it's an interesting little thing to note in that something that existed before I was born and just was a thing, that this is something that exists in the world, FM broadcasting, can just go away. All of it can go away. All of your rights can go away. It was something that really struck me. It's been part of the background of technological existence since I was a wee lad, as those in Scotland with their ZX81s would say. And I found it remarkable that it could be just turned off. This country is going to say, nope, we're out of the FM, out of FM completely. And I guess, it's a spectrum sale thing. And I think it looks like it's a money savings switch rather than an increased in quality switch. Again, I don't know whether this is actually overall positive or negative. I don't think we're looking at something like this happening in North America anytime soon. The North American systems for digital things, I think, they're called overcarrier or something like that. So it's a different sort of doohickey, so I don't think we're looking at it's a one or another choice here in North America, but I did think it was interesting. It really struck me as notable and strange that a country would just turn off FM radio. So goodbye, FM. Hello, AM. And that's Norway. They'll sit in the cold, happy, prosperous, but no FM radio.
Huh. Weird. I mean, I guess I was thinking my impression of FM is always that it was sort of corporate controlled in a way. Like you didn't really have little pirate FM stations nearly to the degree that you have AM stations. That sort of seems a little bit more accessible. So I would be kind of freaked out actually if AM went away, because then it does seem like suddenly we're being cast off without any recourse to organize. But
in fact, if AM went away, I would be particularly disappointed. I don't listen to a lot of terrestrial radio anymore, but I have a typewriter that I adore, a little manual typewriter. It has built into the lid an AM radio. It's a typewriter from the 60s, and it's gorgeous. The industrial design is just beautiful, and I love the fact that it ships with a radio. I just adore that. So I would be disappointed for my typewriter if we lost AM. But you're right, FM is a tool of the man.
And I don't think AM's going anywhere anytime soon. It's not that big a chunk of bandwidth. There wouldn't be that much use for it in other commercial purposes. Just like in the shortwave radio world, a lot of shortwave stations, even some of the big state-sponsored broadcasters have been either going off the air or threatening to go off the air or reducing the number of markets that they broadcast to. I think it's just the march of technology. I mean, we saw analog broadcast television go the way of the dodo not that long ago. And that to me was a bigger shock. I was thinking, oh my gosh, really? So now no more analog TV. That seemed like a bigger deal. Turning off FM radio. Yeah, I don't know if I like that or not either, what Norway's doing.
First they came for your television.
Yeah, then they came for your radio. Yeah.
I, for one, am against the march of technology.
Well, I mean, we're here, right, on the retro computing roundtable.
Oh, is that where we are?
But
cool.
You know, I think in terms of effect to our hobby, maybe analog TV might actually have a bigger effect in the long term, because TVs that come out that don't have any kind of analog tuner, they wouldn't be able to work with our old computers. Mm-hmm. I don't know. If you buy a modern TV, I think it still has to have an analog tuner for cable, right? So I don't know if we're in any danger of that anytime soon either, but interesting.
Carrying it, is there any chance that your typewriter could be upgraded to play Pandora or Sirius?
Yes, if you put a Pandora or Sirius receiver directly adjacent to it.
Super glue.
That sounds
and then
like
it could act as an echo chamber.
That's a super feasible solution. Excellent. I will look forward to seeing it at Hackfest. Fantastic. All right. The next news item, it looks like I'm somehow next on the list. I never know how these get ordered, such as they are, but here I am. Talking about the same thing I talked about as my host gift idea the last time I was on the show, which was in October. That's right. I'm hosting two shows in a row. I really need to start protesting this, which is the 8-bit do Nintendo 8-bit do. That's right. Paul corrected me on the pronunciation last time, and I remembered. Thank you for embarrassing me for the second show in a row, Paul.
No problem. I'm just sitting there.
And all but your memory burns. Anyway, 8-bit do is the Hong Kong manufacturer of the AP40, which is a wireless Bluetooth controller that they recently funded on Kickstarter to release an Apple-themed version of their joystick. The hardware is the same, but now it has a Apple Rainbow logo skin to it. And depending
don't
on
we all
that's possible. And depending on at what level you backed it on Kickstarter, you will also receive a wireless receiver that allows the controller to work on your Apple II, a Bluetooth controller on your Apple II, speaking of favorite retro gaming input devices. Now, these devices are now shipping and now arriving, and one member of the Apple II community at least has received his, that being Mr. Chris Torrance of the Assembly Lines podcast and also a Kansas Fest alumnus. He has unboxed the joystick and the receiver on YouTube and on his Patreon channel, where I'm a backer, and he then did a follow-up video showing the controller working different games. And it seems like the controller works best wirelessly with games that need only digital input, such as Lode Runner or Dino Eggs. It does not work well with analog games like Choplifter or Castle Wolfenstein, where you need finer control. There are analog thumbsticks on the joypad, but with most Apple II games, if not all, it only registers 0 or 255. There's nothing in between. And so that can be a problem with a lot of games, as you can imagine. If you're not playing a game where you need that middle ground, where it's just either on or off binary, then great. You can use the analog joystick or the digital D-pad that are on the controller. For everything else, it seems a little iffy. I'm looking forward to seeing more details about the controller and its compatibility in a future issue of Juice GS, blatant plug. But in the meantime, I'm glad I canceled my pledge for this Kickstarter, because it does not sound like the sort of high-quality, cross-compatible product that I would have wanted. Has anybody else gotten one of these?
Nope.
No, I did see the YouTube video, though, and I got to tell you, it looks neat. That doesn't necessarily make it play well, but
yeah, the idea for the product is great, and that's why I originally backed it, but it sounds like they were really trying to shoehorn one of their existing devices into another platform, and I don't know how much about the Apple II they actually know. I don't know. I mean, they don't seem to be a member of the community, per se, where like they interact with us on social media, but I don't know. They just... I'm not sure they really understood what it is that we as Apple II gamers want and need. Anyway, Paul, tell us about the BBC.
Yes. Okay. Right. So the BBC news website published January 15th. It published programming in the early days of the computer age, and you know it's basically kind of a story of centered around Joyce Wheeler, who used the EDSAC. The Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator in 1949. It leads off by saying, everyone remembers the first computer they ever used, and Joyce Wheeler is no exception. But in her case, the situation was a bit different. The first computer she used was one of the first computers anyone used. And it sort of goes on talking about how they were simulating nuclear reactions in stars and things like this. And what I think was kind of neat about it mainly was just that it's in the... You know, it's on the BBC site. You know, it's sort of mainstream press looking at this. So kind of a nice little read. It doesn't take very long to go through. They have some pictures of a copy of EDSAC, which is apparently their copy editors were not paying attention because it is subtitled a koi of EDSAC, but I will assume it is a copy being built at the National Museum of Computing. So anyway, I didn't have much more to say about that other than just to say take a look at it and the pictures and the fact that it's on the BBC.
I think some of these photographs might have been photoshopped. I mean, looking at the one picture of the EDSAC, the computer looks all fine, but that looks like it's a woman using it, and girls can't code. He said, waiting for Quinn to write in.
Right.
Who ever heard of a female programmer? Oh, wait. They might have started before. Anyway, couldn't resist.
Yes, very
wow.
Nice. 1949. Well, I mean, you know, 1949, the sort of like the beginning of this era was much more sort of populated by women programmers than...
Mm-hmm. And then boys did what boys do best.
Yoink.
We ruined it.
Need I mention that just this past November, Margaret Hamilton, the engineer behind the Apollo software that
Never
put humanity on the moon, won the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. Also photoshopped.
Right.
Obama was photoshopped.
And this past Christmas, I gave my 8-year-old nephew and 4-year-old niece different books all about Ada Lovelace, the first programmer who was also a woman.
Never heard of her.
Yeah, although, I am glad that we once again have not managed to make it through without some mention of Apollo. All Apollo all the time.
Kevin Savitz.
Because space stuff is cool.
I thought it was all Kevin Savitz all the time. Oh, no, there he is.
2016.
All right. Carrington, since you have taken over the floor, tell us about a documentary.
Certainly. Then I will tell you about the documentary Viva Amiga. Now, some of you might not know of the computer, the Amiga. As far as I can tell, it was a low-grade Macintosh ripoff. I'm just inviting everyone to write in this episode. So, pretty exciting documentary. It, as in this article we're linked to from Ars Technica, it has now finally been released. I'd heard about this a while ago. It's a documentary that takes basically from the launch of the Amiga 1000 through to the modern day, where people still use Amigas for their business. And if you are an Amiga fan, I never really was, but I do have a lot of respect for the platform. And if you were an Amiga fan, you probably already know about this, but just in case, want to let you know that it is now available for viewing and purchase. It debuted at MAGFest quite recently, and it is now available for viewing online, I think, through... Vimeo, I think, is, or purchase on iTunes, that sort of thing. So it is available. You can snag it. You can watch it. You can relive your Amiga early days or consider whether or not you want to leap in now.
I remember this documentary being funded on Kickstarter way back in July of 2011. That was 6 years ago, and it's finally come out.
Mm-hmm. About time.
Wow, this is back...
Well, the problem is it was rendered on an Amiga. So actually, they finished shooting in 2011, but... took a while. 320 by 240 resolution.
I would believe that. And it's shipping on how many floppy disks? Yeah, this was before Kickstarter required that creators offer a tentative timeline for when rewards would ship. And so without reading through all the project updates and descriptions, I don't know off the top of my head when it was originally anticipated to launch, but I suspect that they did not think it would take 6 years. Good on them for sticking with it and finally getting it out there, because documentaries like this need to exist, even if it is this Amiga.
And I do want to point out that this comes really fast on the heels of 8-bit generation, the Commodore Wars, also coming out fairly recently. And it was really good, narrated by Bill Hurd, famous guy in the Commodore community, basically the creator of the Commodore 128 computer, he and his team. And done very well with some interviews that I think are noteworthy because they were the somewhat enigmatic and reclusive Jack Tramiel, who actually decided that he was going to be interviewed for this. And it was really great to get his side of that whole Commodore story and some of the other characters in there. So if, you know, you want... to watch historical Commodore documentaries, and of course, who doesn't, really? Let's just be honest with ourselves. Then you could watch 8-Bit Generation, the Commodore Wars, and then follow it up with Viga Amiga, and you'd have the whole story. You'd basically know everything that was important in computing.
God.
Yeah, no, I
would like to rebut.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching this. I don't care how long it took. It's now that it's here, I'm very happy that it is. I sort of have this guilt about the Amiga in a sense that, like, I know it's a good computer. I've never been kind of like drawn to it because I think, you know, by the time I was kind of aware of it, it was, you know, I was on to other things. You know, it was sort of in the past, but I know it was ahead of its time back before its time. So anyway, glad it's out.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll talk about marketing and distribution. One big problem of the Amiga back in the day and the computing target-rich environment of Los Angeles, where I lived, you just couldn't find one in a store to go take a look at and demo and that. Some people who lived in that area might know the store or two where they were located. They might write in to tell me I'm full of baloney. And if you do, please do, because I'd like to know this, because I, for the life of me, couldn't find one. I was a big Commodore enthusiast. So it wasn't that it wasn't a great computer. It was a little pricey, but where could you even see one? That was a big deal. I'm sorry, Ken, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Nor did I mean to be cut off. So there. No, I relatedly just remembered 3 years ago, uploaded to YouTube was this 14-minute video called Doomed, The Embers of Amiga FPS. And it's all about the history of first-person shooters on the Amiga platform, which is amazing because if you think about the history of first-person shooters on the Apple II, you have Wolf 3D, and that's pretty much it. So the fact that Amiga had enough games in that genre to be competitive in the market for that era and to have even just a 15-minute documentary made about it is really fascinating. I have never touched an Amiga in my life, and I thought this 14-minute video was worth every second of my time. So I highly recommend it. Link in the show notes. Moving on, let's see. Earl, you have a little computer you want to talk to us about.
I do. This was a great project brought to my attention by the people who did it. And it's over on element14.com, which is a maker site that has all kinds of electronic doodads, Arduino doodads, you know, different project ideas. And I think even Ben Heck's videos are sponsored by Element 14. Anyhow, they've got a community site where people can post the things that they work on. And this particular one took a Raspberry Pi as the heart of it, but created a retro-inspired computer that I think is just beautiful. It's a father-daughter project, and I always think those are fantastic. You know, getting some quality time in, building something fun. And this one shows some really awesome craftsmanship as well. There was some woodworking to build the case, some innovative cabling and design to bring out the connectors from the Raspberry Pi to the front and back. They've even got something that they call, you know, like their cartridge ROM port in the front. And also, the case and design that they came up with looks remarkably like a Sol 20 in both the shape and the paint color. And I'm told that was just a fortunate accident, that it wasn't designed to model after that. It just, you know, that's what came out of all this. But you can see the photographs of all of the craftsmanship going on. They took just a raft of photos and put them up there on this posting. And in the end, it works, and they even labeled their little SD cards that they called their ROMs that they can put in for different operating systems or software choices that you can run on this thing. So I thought it was worth mentioning, and they, you know, they were going for something that looked retro, and I think they hit it dead on. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at this, but I think it's just beautiful.
It's worth going to the site just to look at them reshape the keyboard.
Yes.
This great photo of a keyboard and a hacksaw. The keyboard's too large, so let's just take a hacksaw to it. I'm like, that is the way you solve problems.
It looks fantastic, though. It looks great.
Excellent. Thank you, Earl. Let's see. Next up on the list is me again with an item that I was tossed at the last minute just so I would have something to talk about. Let's see knowledgeably I can speak about a video I have not watched.
Pity Link.
Yes, indeed. So the Game Developers Conference, or GDC, is an annual video game convention primarily for people who are in the software development industry, specifically electronic entertainment. It has been going on for decades, and one of the hallmarks of this annual event are the postmortems, where developers get up and talk about what went on behind the scenes when they were creating one of their landmark games. Sometimes this is a game that has just recently come out, and so the memories are still fresh, and they can talk about what went right or what went wrong. But just as often, these postmortems are for games that are decades old, which predate GDC. You have such presenters as John Romero or Warren Robinette up there talking about their games. And recently, all these talks are captured on video and are added to GDC's extensive online vault, which is just a fantastic archive and resource. One of the videos that was recently added to the archive and which can now be watched on YouTube is the GDC 2016 postmortem of Ms. Pac-Man as delivered by General Computer designer Steve Golson. You may recall that although Midway was the supposed developer and distributor of Ms. Pac-Man, Steve Golson and his team were the ones that hacked the original Pac-Man to be Crazy Auto, which then got picked up by the development team responsible for Pac-Man and turned into an official sequel as opposed to just a bootleg, and that is how Ms. Pac-Man came about. This one-hour video talks all about how he and his team hacked the original Pac-Man to make Crazy Auto, and then how it got turned into Ms. Pac-Man. It's a great opportunity to hear the story right from the source, and it's a piece of our gaming history, so to have it captured while it's still available to be told by the people who were there when it happened is just fantastic. Has anybody else here listened to a GDC Vault talk before, or a postmortem?
Yep, I love them. They are fantastic. Big, big fan of the format and big fan of the info that they convey. There's a really good one about Infocom's game Zork that I remember we talked about in the first episode of Eaten by a Gru, another podcast I do. And it was just like amazing to have a fellow from Infocom talk about how they designed games and how they kind of didn't really design them but made them up as they went, and just talk about the nitty-gritty details of a game design. I have watched this video for the Ms. Pac-Man one. I'm a big fan of the postmortems in general. Mortems in general. Not modems. Big fan of postmortems. Screw you, modems. I'm all about Sneakernet. So yeah, they're always worth watching, and if you have any interest in the game that's being covered, then you will inevitably find them incredibly fascinating and full of neat little juicy tidbits. So
there's also a really a good one by David Crane on Pitfall too that was a 2011 postmortem, one of the first ones that I had actually become aware of in this format.
Excellent. Yeah, I love how many classic developers are contributing to this archive. I think it's fascinating. Moving on, Paul, what is going on in the handheld world of the Palm?
Well, so I grabbed this. I was sort of like flailing around for something to talk about, and I noticed that this had just been posted January 12th, so quite recently, on OS News. The elusive Palm OS 5.5 Garnet emulator for Windows Linux, and it's a little description. Now, okay, so this is a little bit, I mean, it's still retro. It's a little bit newer retro. Partly what was bringing this, you know, into my mind was that there, fairly recently on the Apple II Enthusiasts group, was a post where David Schmenk had put, he'd basically gotten out, I think he got out some Palm device and was trying out his, an emulator that he wrote. And I, of course, had no idea. Now I know David Schmenk from Kansas Fest and other context things, other things that he's done. But I didn't know that he was the one who wrote that program, and I used that program on my, you know, like I, on my Trio and various Palm devices in the past. So it's been sort of interesting to kind of like revisit this. And what was interesting about that thread is that many people chimed in and said, oh yeah, I used this, and no, it's crashing on mine and all this stuff. And it became kind of like a Palm discussion. But so in this article, this is posted by, looks like, Tom Halwerda. So this is somebody who basically has been collecting all of the Palm OS releases. So I forget exactly how the corporate structure worked here, but there was, at least sort of early on, there was this Palm Incorporated. They got sold, I think, to 3Com. I'm not sure exactly what the transition was. But anyway, there was the operating system that ran the thing was Palm OS, and it was primarily on Palm devices, although it did, you know, there were a few other devices that ran Palm OS. I have a pretty late machine called, what was it called? Dana is the name. Alpha Smart Dana, which is a widescreen Palm. So Tom was collecting these, like all of the major Palm OS releases, but didn't have the penultimate one, which was 5.5, because I guess he was under the impression that it was basically never released. You know, then Palm kind of folded. So he was sort of writing up, you know, like this was missing, and kind of going through all of the, you know, his story with collecting these things, and his discovery just recently, actually aided by somebody who wrote to him on Twitter saying, "Hey, do you have this one of the Windows and Linux version of Palm OS 5.5 emulator, the virtual machine?" So if you are interested, it kind of goes through and talks about it. He doesn't actually provide it, but he does provide a link to the tweet that provided it to him. So if you go there quickly, there's, you know, a MediaFire link that has this on it. At least in the article, he's saying that he's a bit reluctant to make a, you know, compiled zip file of all of the versions and hand it out. But if you don't have that kind of problem, you can quickly go to the tweet that led him to it. That's it.
Excellent. No, I think it's fascinating that there's still so much stuff being done with retro Palm devices or retro mobile and handheld devices. I think they are sometimes forgotten when we're talking about retro computing. When I saw David Schmink's video about the Apple II emulator for Palm, I thought that was really cool and not something I ever would have thought of. So I'm glad to hear that there's even more stuff being discussed and archived in that realm. Hey, did anybody here have a Palm? I had one briefly that I won in a raffle, and I never even turned it on. I just immediately sold it to a K-Fester and was happy to pocket the $100. I remember really debating with myself back in 2001 if I wanted a Palm device. It felt like it'd be a great way to organize my calendar and my contacts, but I ultimately decided I just wasn't that important enough to warrant having a Palm.
Yeah, no, I did. I loved them, actually. I had several of them. I had the first one I actually owned myself was a 3XE, which is a little, you know, black and white, relatively large one, in mostly the original form factor. And then after that, I won a 7, which was a wireless one that actually had a connection to a kind of like proprietary little web network, if you paid a lot of money for it. I forget exactly how I won that. I think I bought an app from a store that was having a giveaway and won it, so that was kind of cool. And then I bought Trio, whatever it is, 650, I think, which was in color. That was exciting. And that was my phone for a couple of years until after that I went to the iPhone, and that was the end of the Palm line anyway. But I used them and loved them, and, you know, I have more of them now,
I remember feeling bad for Apple II user Eric Shepard, a.k.a. Sheppy, because when I was in college, he worked for B, like the operating system for the Macintosh, B. And when that ended up not working out, when B sort of went away, he left B and worked for Palm. And then Palm went away. I'm like, Sheppy, I don't know if you're just... if you have bad luck or you are bad luck. I'm not sure. Like, I don't think Apple should hire you, because I'd hate to see what would happen then. Fortunately, he had actually already worked for Apple, and obviously they did great, and he now works for Mozilla, and they do great. So it was just a run of bad luck. But he, even in those two environments, he still did amazing things. So, and they were amazing companies, and I'm sorry that they didn't work out. But
I know I sort of thought of Palm as kind of Apple-like in a way. You know, I'm not sure if that was fair, but I sort of had the same friendly outlook toward them when I was using their stuff.
Palm and Apple?
Yeah.
What is the correlation that you see?
Oh no, it was just sort of like the company atmosphere. I'm not sure exactly what word I'm looking for, but
philosophy?
Maybe. And quite, you know, this is quite an uninformed consumer opinion here, but maybe it's just because I had one, I liked it, you know.
I would not say that you are an uninformed consumer, Paul.
Half-informed consumer, then.
All right.
Misinformed consumer.
Oh, that's most people. Speaking of old operating systems, Carrington, let's close out the
speaking
news.
Speaking of misinformed.
Right. Let's close out the news section with your piece.
Oh, this is a really interesting article. If you were a Macintosh programmer back in the PowerPC days, then you probably are familiar with MetroWorks CodeWarrior. You'll even know that MetroWorks spells it with fewer O's than you might think in that name. I was a huge fan of CodeWarrior back in the day, and so if names like ThinkC or if you're even older, Lightspeed C, that sort of stuff, if all this rings a bell with you in a nice way, you'll want to scurry off to a link we'll have in the show notes about compiling a Mac OS 8 application on Mac OS Sierra. So a fellow named Matt Gallagher was a developer of a using ThinkC or LightSpeed C, one of the two, but using CodeWarrior way, way back in the late 90s, he developed a Minesweeper game and still had all the original code and thought, well, I wonder what it would take to get that to compile and run under a modern Macintosh operating system, under Sierra. And so this is essentially a write-up of doing that. It is like a postmortem. And a little bit of spoiler, he is successful, but it's really interesting to read what he has to go through. The actual compiling of the game and getting it to work was really quick and relatively easy, but the installation of everything needed to get to the point of compiling took some hoops and some time. So there was hoop jumping, definitely. But really neat to read him going through this and what it takes to bring forward, essentially. Let's bring something forward 18 years into the future. And really neat, and hopefully it will inspire others to do the same thing if you've got code lying around from the late 90s or early 2000s from PowerPC days. So really neat. I found it a fascinating read. Lots of examples and screenshots and such. Really detailed. And you can even, when you go there, you can download the copy of Mines and play it for yourself if you'd like. So I was really happy to read this, and I'm happy to pass on the link.
Yeah, that's really cool. I remember CodeWarrior fondly, and their annoying subscription service or subscription model. I have, you know, a few of the packages because the art on them is actually kind of nice. It's very, you know, construction based.
Yeah, I had some of their Geekware T-shirts and things. I was a big fan of CodeWarrior. It was my IDE of choice for a bunch of years, and I liked it. And that's back in the days where you'd get the Apple developer CDs as well. And I just, you know, I kind of wish I'd hung on to those neat little hidden things in them. And you're right, the CodeWarrior art itself was great. CodeWarrior itself, as far as I know, still exists, but it's owned by a different company now, and it's an IDE for other. I think microprocessors or something. It's, you know, they're out of the Macintosh game, and is no longer owned by MetroWorks. Hmm.
This was the official way that you were supposed to build Palm applications too. So I have like the Palm specific version of CodeWarrior as well. But and I do have a couple of old apps that might be kind of interesting to try to make compile.
There you go. Yeah, it motivated me to think as well, what code might I have lying around in backups from back then? Because I developed tons of stuff. A lot of it was for companies who probably wouldn't want me to release their internal systems. But maybe I've got something that was more public. Just really, really, really interesting. Just neat to see the CodeWarrior disks again, and neat to see screenshots from the IDE. So brought back a lot of memories.
Great. Thank you so much, Carrington, and off we go to this week's Vintage Commercial.
Computers? Who's got time to figure out how to use them?
That's how the owners of a clothing store, father and son, felt about personal computers, until they got one. And a catering business, until they got one. We're IBM, and we've seen some very skeptical people become very enthusiastic. And that makes us proud, because we have more computers helping more small businesses than anybody. IBM Personal Computers. Small business is getting big on them.
And we're back. This week's host retro computing gift idea is one that is near and dear to my heart. It is a core memory shield for the Arduino. If you like your single board mini microcomputers like the Raspberry Pi, and you also like super old and impractical methods for storing memory, then this is the device for you.
And this is the podcast for you, frankly.
That is true. It's the best of both worlds. This is a DIY kit for building a 32-bit ferrite core memory. Core memory is non-volatile, which is great because it means that it preserves its contents even when the power is turned off. However, this type of memory is so power-hungry, and it requires a lot of space and needs to be protected from strong magnetic fields. Also, the process of reading the memory destroys its contents so that every read must immediately be followed with a write to restore the memory that you just read. It's ridiculous.
It's wonderful.
Isn't it?
I love it. I love core memory. Just the look of it is so, it should never have worked, and it does, and I adore. Well, I guess maybe it should have worked. I don't know the electronics behind it. I just, when you look at basically what looks like a piece of fence, see, that's what I'm storing my data on.
Pretty much. It looks like you're trying to keep the memory from physically escaping. You have
using a hammock.
You know, it is not metaphorically a cage. It is literally a cage for
your
memory.
It's a dream catcher for data is what it is, and I adore core memory.
That is a wonderful way to put it. A dream catcher for memory. That's excellent. So if you want to create a dream catcher for your Arduino's memory, you can do so at this Tindy.com store, where a gentleman in Finland has created a DIY kit with which you can create a core memory shield for your Arduino. It is $39.90. Shipping to the United States starts at $4, and it usually ships within one day. And this product has actually been on his store for about a year and a half. He has sold 33 of them, and he has two reviews. Let me click on the reviews and see how positive they are. They are both completely, well, glowing, yeah. 5 stars. It looked like he maybe has like 4.9 on one of them, but people really recommend it. It looks like you might also be able to buy it pre-assembled based on one of the reviews that I'm seeing. I haven't dug into the details of that. But yeah, a great way to merge your Arduino device with the best memory method of the old days.
This is definitely the best memory that the 60s could buy. And you got to think about this. If somebody said to you, build me a RAM chip, you know, could you do it? You might be able to throw some transistors together and come up with a 1-bit latch or something. But here, you're literally building the memory, like running wires through the little ferrite core. So not only do you get a glimpse into the innovation that was core memory, you know, decades ago, but you also get to put together actual memory that you're making yourself. This thing is so cool. I can't think of, how much more to say how cool it is. So
it's got me thinking though, if you had a huge amount of storage requirements, if it could actually double as a fence. Now I'm thinking that like big industrial areas in the 60s should have had fencing around them that was actually secretly core memory. And when somebody tries to break in by cutting the fence, they're like, we can tell because we just dropped some records from the database.
Yeah, we lost 5 bits in sector 3.
Somebody must be breaking in.
Yeah, so you get it's 32-bit memory. That's not too bad.
Yeah, only 32 bits. When you say 32-bit right. memory,
32
let's be clear.
Memory. I love it. I adore, and even just the look of this card is great. Like I would just want to have it and put it on a wall. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous kit.
Excellent. Let's talk about some other things that we can spend our hard-earned money on feeding our retro computing habit online. There have been a number of notable eBay auctions as of late. Carrington, tell us about yours.
Mine's not on eBay, so there, ha! I almost always pick an eBay auction, but this time I decided to go a little bit different. If you are in, I think this is Sweden, let's say Sweden. If you are in Sweden and want to pick up some Silicon Graphics computers, well, there is a forum post, the NicoChanNet post, and which seems to be a place where people talk about this kind of hardware, so maybe you'd already be aware of it. But just in case, I thought I'd throw this one up as an alternative to the usual auction pick. So a fellow is leaving the collecting, leaving the hobby, and has a very sizable hoard of Spark stations and just like everything you can think of that Silicon Graphics, computers and other bits and Ethernet things and monitors and the whole shebang. It is, however, available only for, as far as I can tell, local pickup. So if you are in Sweden and want to pick up some or all of a very large collection of Silicon Graphics computers, that is my auction choice. I don't know anything about these things. I don't know what costs they're looking for, but it's something a little different than the usual. So I thought I would bring it to a wider audience, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, the SGIs have a pretty rabid following. People really love their SGI machines, and looking through this post, it looks like a couple of these are among the more sought after of the SGIs. So this is pretty cool. So
yeah, so I'm collecting, my choice is all of the SGI stuff.
Yeah, so Jack, if you're listening, because
that's why Jack isn't here right now. He's probably off picking up all
these. He's off picking up these SGI computers.
These are the ones that are all the nice colors, right? Indigo, yeah.
Yeah, I actually...
Yeah, blue and stuff.
They are. They're very cool. I have an Indigo 2 in my own collection, and one of the sample things that it does is run Doom, and It's pretty amazing how well it runs Doom for a computer of that era. And then I looked at what it cost when this thing was brand new, and I think... I don't remember if it was $30,000 or $50,000. It's just an amazing amount that somebody would have paid for this workstation that I got in a set of four for $60. But
a friend of mine worked at a place that had a bunch of SGI stuff way back in the day and invited me over after hours once. And we played like a 3D tank game that was over the network. And it was crazy and mind-blowing and wonderful. But it was quite obvious that these are all computers that would be way out of my home computing price range.
Yeah, they were pricey, but very cool.
Excellent. Moving on to the next auction. We have one from Earl.
I have no idea what this board does, but there are two things about it that I really like. One is it's 68,000 based, which is neat because that's a great chip. The other is that it is made by Hughes Aircraft, and it was made there, judging from the date code on the board, when I worked for Hughes Aircraft. Now, I did not make this board. So, you know, we had 70,000 people that worked for Hughes Aircraft at the time. But I was so intrigued to see a computer board on eBay from Hughes Aircraft made actually by Western Digital. I didn't even know that Hughes had any agreements with Western Digital. The best I was able to Google was that this was some sort of industrial controller, like a PLC. And I don't know anything more about it other than it was just cool to see Hughes Aircraft on it, and it's an old computer board from 1990. So that's my eBay pick. Completely useless. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, something more useless, unless, of course, you have some industrial equipment that uses one of these boards and it's broken and you need this. In that case, you could have it for $80, buy it now, or even make an offer if you're feeling spunky. But, you know, take a look at it. It's got lots of chips with lots of labels and stuff like that. And somewhere in the bowels of one of the buildings for the company that I worked at, you know, these things got cranked out.
You said bowel.
I did. So
I see it's been tested. Has a little sticker on it that says tested.
Definitely,
can't read any of the rest of it.
You definitely want to test these because they did some important thing that I have no clue about.
Right.
Yeah, but just because something's tested doesn't mean it passed. Right. I can be tested for anything right now. You want to test me for rocket sized things or diseases? Whatever. Who knows? Some I'll pass, some I'll fail. I won't tell you which. So I don't know. I want to see something working. Then you know it's good. Well, but I think this is really cool. Yeah, I've never seen this before.
Look at those bus connectors, though. Those super high density bus connectors. You know this connected to something important.
Right. You can just tell from looking at it.
So that's my most esoteric pick ever. But just, you know, being Hughes Aircraft alumni, I had to do it.
Well done, Earl. Thank you. And finally, we saved the most voluminous for the last, Paul.
Yes. Excellent. Yeah, I have a sort of a random set of things here. So the first one I'm going to talk about is the MP32C64 device. It is a data set. It's a Commodore data set emulator. And it's a little kit. It's actually super cheap. It's $21 free shipping from Spain. I don't know, Earl, if you've seen this before, but it's basically, it's an alternative to, you can have these devices that will take like an SD card and make it into a disk drive emulator, that sort of thing for various computers, including the Commodore. This one is actually emulating the cassette. So it's basically, it's a very simple kit. There's not very much stuff to put together, but it has the right connector. It has an audio input, and you can plug this into any of the Commodore computers that take a cassette. So I thought this was kind of a neat thing. It's a neat project, and it will, at least in some sense, bring your computer into the modern world, because you don't have to have a working data set, at least. That's the name of the Commodore brand cassette tape player. It actually doesn't have, it connects with a sort of a proprietary connector that you can't just use any, at least as far as I know, you can't just use any cassette player with the Commodore. Is that right, Earl? Am I getting this wrong?
No, that's correct. The Commodore had a digital connector to the cassette deck. And I have seen these before. These are pretty darn cool. You could hook them up to an MP3 player and play in a game and actually load it like you'd load a tape. And in the U.S., we might not be as familiar with why in the world would you want to do this, but overseas, games and programs on tape for Commodores and for a lot of the other computers like the Spectrums and that were a lot more common. So finding something in the tape format might be more feasible in that sort of context. So, yeah, this is neat and cheap. And, you know, when all the rubber pieces and belts and all that in your tape deck melt away, then you might want one of these to keep you going. If you're into that slow sort of load that you get from the tape, I mean, you don't want things to operate too fast.
That's what it says on my Tinder profile, into that slow sort of load. There's a lot of swiping in whatever direction is the direction of that. I think it's funny that they use, you can't just hook up a standard cassette player to them. I did not know that. So I guess it was cassettes for the classes, not the masses. Is that what we're doing there? Bunch of hypocrites.
Maybe. Although I will say this, and you'll find this among the people who use tape, that the Commodore tape decks were pretty dang reliable in terms of not eating your program. And eating your program,
well, as far as you
bad.
Know, they're still loading.
No, that's the disk drive.
Well, and the cool thing about this is that, if I'm not mistaken, that it's actually compatible with a wide range of Commodore computers. So you can use it on your PET as well as on your VIC-20 and C64.
Could go all the way to the 128 with those babies.
Cool. Cool. Actually, the same seller. So the seller is Kopsech. I don't know. Kopsec. Has some assembled ones, and the assembled ones come in a little case with a sticker that looks like it's like a photographic, basically, rendition of the data set on top of it. So it's like this little tiny thing, as wide as the plug. If you look at the other items by the seller, you can see those. It's very cute. So if you wanted to get an assembled one, I could get it for $44.63 from Spain. So not just a circuit board, but actually in a little case, which is quite cute.
Nice.
Let's see. So the next one is kind of similar. The XTCF Lite Compact Flash 8-bit ISA IDE adapter with boot ROM and bracket. So this is, I'm sure we've talked about these before. This is a CF card adapter for things like the PC, the IBM PC. It works on the PC and the XT. I actually just bought one of these not long ago. Hasn't arrived yet, but I was intending to put this in my portable 5155 because it's a nice short little card, and it would, and you know, it should work on that. But so if you don't have a working hard drive on your early IBM or ISA kind of computer, this seems like a pretty nice thing. And it actually, I believe, can boot from it. It says it has a ROM on it that will allow it to boot in almost anything. I think it'll work in an AT and an XT and a 5150. So looks very cool. Anyone have one of those? I guess Earl, you're the only candidate who might.
I would love to have one because I have a PS2 Model 30 and the hard drive is kind of toast in it. One of the four platters on the hard drive gave up the ghost. And in fact, I think I might even send the seller the question of whether or not a Model 30 will boot from this instead of from the internal hard drive. He says he tests them on PS2 Model 30s, which is a great sign. But I just want to make sure it can replace the hard drive. And if so, you might have just cost me some money, Paul.
Sorry. Yeah. I have a like just a straight line CF adapt IDE to CF adapter that I was able to just stick on a controller card in was it a Compaq Portable 2. So it just just using a CF card as a straight hard drive. But I think this has the controller card logic on it as well. So you don't need a card for this. This is the card. The next thing I have is not something I'm necessarily expecting people to buy, but I thought it was kind of interesting. It's the Dancing Demon demo for the TRS-80. I guess Model 1 even would run this, but it's the booklet and the tape, and it's a very famous demo. It's being sold here for $310. Buy it now. And it's rare. I don't know why it's so rare because it's so famous, but maybe everybody just made a copy of it. But at any rate, if you wanted to see it, there is one on eBay now. Anyone know the demo? Everyone know
I
the
do
demo?
Not. I had a Model 1 back in the day, but I do not know the Dancing Demon demo.
Oh, it's really it's remarkable. You should definitely go
is it see it. $300 remarkable?
No. But,
make offer. Or is it go look at it on YouTube remarkable?
Yeah, look at it on YouTube, though. It's really, you will not believe that it was a Model 1 doing that. It's really, really quite,
You will believe a demon can dance.
it's an animation, basically. I think there's music as well. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it is at least dancing, and it's a relatively full screen. I mean, it's not something you would expect a TRS-80 to be able to do. At least not something I had expected. So anyway, there's that. In sort of a similar vein, there's a auction for the AppleSoft reference manual from Apple Software Bank. And what's interesting about this, the world is, we're swimming in AppleSoft reference manuals. But this is actually the first version. What we're swimming in are actually AppleSoft 2 reference manuals. This one is for AppleSoft before there was AppleSoft 2. It is a letter-sized manual that's blue that says AppleSoft down the right side. It is super, super rare. There's a book that came with the original Apple IIs that's like this but red, and it's called the Apple II Reference Manual. And those are a little bit easier to find, but they're also considered to be pretty rare. This blue one is much more difficult to find.
I've never seen this.
I have a shirt, actually, that has this design on it. But
you probably have three of these, but yeah. I have never actually seen it.
Yeah, cool. I have one of them. But what I don't have is, and what I'd never seen before this auction, by the way, I should say, if you go and look at this auction, it's in terrible shape. This one is not in good shape at all, but what I had never seen before.
You want that little quick reference guy, don't you?
Yeah, that's exactly it. it's also in bad shape, but I didn't know that existed at all. So there's a little, I don't know what it is, it's about a quarter letter size thing. It says AppleSoft Quick Reference Guide.
$200, it could be yours.
It's a, yeah. I think I will pass. It does have make an offer. But and I wish it wasn't in such bad shape, but I didn't know that thing existed, and maybe you didn't either. So, okay, I think that will do it for my auctions. I had one more in the list that I will talk about at the end.
Oh, you tease. When you say at the end, you mean the closing discussions?
Yes.
Well then, why don't we go there, because there are no more eBay auctions on the list. Paul, why don't you start?
All right. Yeah, perfect. Okay, so one of the things that I got not very long ago is this very rare product by Apple called the Apple Line. And it's like super boring looking. It's a box. I don't know if I've talked about it this before, but it's a box. It's designed basically to allow you to connect your Apple II or Apple III or Lisa or Mac to an IBM mainframe. So it's all of the. It's basically it speaks in IBM 3270 protocol. So you plug your Apple computer into the Apple Line, and then the Apple Line talks to the mainframe. There are very few of these. I think it's quite possible that they were leased out or something, which is why they maybe didn't. Why so few survived. But so a while back, I got the manuals. Like a couple of years ago, I got the manuals. I actually finally got a device now. So I have the Apple Line device. Of course, the thing is that, like, it's kind of useless, right? So, because it's supposed to plug into a mainframe, and I don't have a mainframe.
Now you have to go get a mainframe.
Well, so what just arrived a couple days ago was an IBM 3174 that I bought, which is a terminal cluster controller, so that I can plug my Apple into my Apple Line into the cluster controller. And I'm not going.
Oh, it's a cluster, all right.
Cluster, yeah, right. But and I think that's where I'm going to stop in the route to the mainframe. So what I'm intending to do is to try to run a Z system emulator. There's something called Hercules that will pretend to be an IBM mainframe, and I'm hoping that I can figure out some way to interface. What I would like to do, I'm not sure if this is feasible, is to run the mainframe on a Raspberry Pi. but I have. Like,
I think
a real...
Hercules will run on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. So that's my new little project. Unfortunately, the 3174 is one of many possible cluster controllers, and this one is actually pretty small. I think you can only plug in like three or four terminals to it. But I mean, you can get them in many. Like, I know very little about the whole IBM mainframe world, but I'm starting to get a little bit into it. So so I have this 3174. One thing I don't one bad thing is it got kind of banged up in shipping, so I have to super glue some pieces back together. But it also has a disk drive. It's like it's some high. It's like a not remembering. It's like 2.44 megabyte drive or something like that. It's an unusually dense floppy drive that is where you put the microcode to make the thing start. And if it doesn't have anything sort of like in its non-volatile memory, I might still have to figure out some way to source this microcode disk and a disk of that size. But anyway, so
very interesting project, though.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty cool if I can get it to actually go. So that's my new thing. I guess the only other thing that's been happening, I'm about to close off, I think, the second month of editing the most recent Drop 3 Inches podcast episode. We recorded it in November, and then but actually, what was interesting, the thing I wanted to mention about this is that we interviewed Don Burtis, who is the guy who created the soft card, the Microsoft soft card, which, you know, had a huge effect on the Apple II world. It was there was a time, he said, that the largest population of CPM users were Apple II users, which was pretty cool. So anyway, I'm looking forward to getting that out, but so listen to that. That's it. Oh, no, it isn't it. I didn't talk about my eBay thing.
Oh, my goodness.
So the eBay thing that I didn't talk about is, it says Vintage Irma Boards by DCA, 1987 to 92, model PC 3287P, Irma print, IBM 3270, whatever. And what this is, so Irma, I think, is the... I don't actually know what it is. It's something like the 3270 protocol company, or maybe the some acronym that has to do with the protocol. But many things that are related to the 3270 are called IRMA. And DCA is the company that makes most of them. And so what this is, if you actually look at the listing, it's a kind of a boring beige box that says DCA IRMA print on it, and has on the back it has a place for a printer and a controller power. And what this is, as it turns out, is the exact same thing as the Apple Line. That super rare piece of hardware. The Apple Line actually is just one of these things with an apple on the front. This is much cheaper than the Apple Line, this particular. This is a $25 buy it now. So if you want essentially an Apple Line but without the apple, you can spend like $25 instead of whatever, you know, however many hundreds the Apple one would be. So that was the reason I saved this for then is because now I've already talked about the Apple Line, so this makes some sense.
And man, these suckers were expensive in the 80s. The IRMA and the Forte boards, basically the 3270 boards for the PCs, they had a lot of functionality, but, you know, $4, $5 back in the 80s, I mean, what would that be in today's dollars? It was a lot. So... to see these for $24.
Yeah. But what are you going to use them for? I mean, the best case is basically this thing that I'm going to do, like, you know, making my Raspberry Pi pretend it's a mainframe. So.
I don't see anything wrong with that, honestly.
Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Okay, I'm done.
I got that reference. All right, moving on. Carrington, you have a very sad tale.
Ah, screw him. There's a sad grandpa out there. It is actually sad. So Acheron's Call, a game that I am not familiar with, but it was one of the very early MMORPGs. For our older listeners, an MMORPG is basically a MUD with a chat feature so that teenagers can make fun of you and your mother. So it's been around for quite a while. It came out in November of 1999 and has been running continuously. It's been running always since then. And they've announced that they're shutting down. So end of January, so coming up in a couple of weeks, they will be turning off Acheron's Call's servers. This is one of the downsides of server-based things, DRM-based things, all of it. Everything eventually will make you sad. So being made sad by this in particular and having gone viral is a 74-year-old grandpa who has been playing Acheron's Call since it came out and has, you can imagine, lots and lots of time invested in the game, and they're turning it off, and he and his family will be sad about it. So just gonna link to the video in case you were too happy, you can watch this and lament everything new is being turned off, and that's why you should only play things that don't require servers. Everything else makes you cry.
Thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
No, I mean, it is sad because he's been playing this game for almost 20 years, and I remember when I was a kid, I was very active on CompuServe, and I had a community there in the Apple II users forum. These were people who I recognized and whose company I enjoyed. But CompuServe was so expensive that it got to the point where I had to consider moving to a more affordable service like Genie or Delphi. Even though they offered Apple II support and there were Apple II users on those fora, it would be starting from scratch. It would be building a new community and being a stranger and losing these people who I had known for what felt like ages. It's the same thing with an MMO. It's not just a game he's playing. It's not like he's sitting down and playing Tetris every day, which I've known people to do that, and that's great. But Tetris is primarily a solitary experience, and Acheron's Call is a communal experience. It's something that he has shared with people for 20 years, and when the game goes away, he may move on to other games. His granddaughter is asking for suggestions of alternatives, probably World of Warcraft, for example, but it's not going to be the same, and that's kind of sad. I hope he does choose something, though. I hope he doesn't just take this as a death knell to MMOs and he just stops playing entirely, because I think that would be even sadder.
First of all, only an editor uses fora as the plural for forums. I'm not letting that go.
I wouldn't expect you to let me go if I said forums.
Actually, yeah, I wouldn't have commented. But I'm like, really? Wow. Okay, fine. Whatever. we're more casual here. And also, CompuServe is still up and running. We just didn't tell you.
Oh, I know.
We're all on there now.
No, like CompuServe, Genie, Prodigy, Delphi, they're all still around except for Genie. Genie shut down because it was not Y2K compliant. But the other three are in some fashion still alive, which is amazing. But again...
They actually are? I was kidding, saying that right. We're all on it and we just didn't tell you. CompuServe is a thing that still exists?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Isn't it?
I too was a CompuServe fan. I'm having difficulty getting my head around this.
Sorry to be the one to break it to you, but it's not dead.
No, it's amazing. I might go sign up.
See, you shouldn't have thrown away your modem, Carrington.
I mean, you can go to CompuServe.com right now, and it loads with their font and their logo and everything.
Those for me, but not with the font and stuff. I'm probably blocking the heck out of it.
Oh, it's just part of the header at the top. I recognize it.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, and there are forums or what they... I mean, I see a link to forums. I think they might call them channels now, but...
They call them fora. I might drop my eWorld account and switch back over to CompuServe.
There you go. Oh, my. Huh. Yeah, so these are all still around.
So was CompuServe the one that had the, your username was like a 5-3-digit number or something?
74166,2504. That was me.
I'm stealing your identity now.
Haven't you already done that, Carrington?
That's going to be my new PS4 gamer name.
And people will think it's me. Great.
I know it's great. I'm going to swear like crazy.
Oh, gosh.
In all of the fora.
Earl, please save us. Just save us.
Okay. Fine. I actually have some exciting news. So I received a gift. Some of the...
It's pronounced gift.
Some of the gift, yes. Thank you, CompuServe. Some of the Kyocera portables, which those in the know would recognize means things like the Olivetti or the NEC PC8201A or the famous TR-City Model 100. And I love these portables. And noteworthy among this group of portables that I received was a really decked out 8201A. So this thing has 64K of RAM. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, how can one of those Model 100-like portables have that because they were limited to 32K? Come on, admit it. That's what you guys were thinking, right? So, so since it has 64K, you can switch back and forth between two of the 32K banks, so it's like the computer has a split personality. It's like it's got multiple personality disorder. And if that's not enough, another part of the gift that I received was a 32K battery backed up RAM expansion cartridge. The PC8201A had a gigantic sidecar cartridge slot on the left-hand side of it. And not too many things were made for that cartridge slot, but among them, NEC made a 32K, and you stick one of the like coin style batteries in this sucker, and so then it's got 32K backed up battery RAM for yet more amazing storage on your NEC, and it's got DOS and the option ROM like socket on the back. And the full set of books, I mean, the whole nine yards on the books, the basic reference manual, the unit reference manual, the quick reference guide, this was just such a nice gift. So thank you, Bob, for my portables, because I love them and have been playing around and just enjoying the heck out of this stuff. Do you guys know what I mean when I say the 8201? It's the NEC that looks like the Model 100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I have a box that I'm looking at right now.
Of the 8201?
Portable computer, PC8201A, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's... I have two of them, but... one is in its actual box, but I don't have any of the cool add-ons. That's pretty wild.
I think that I like the keyboard on the 8201 better than I do on the Model 100. Nothing against the Model 100, but that 8201 keyboard really seems to rock.
It has like a diamond cursor on it as well, doesn't it? I think so.
Yes. Yes, that's true. Which is handier than the linear sort of up, down, left, right buttons that you have on the Model 100.
By the way, you mentioned that you can switch back and forth between two ROMs. And immediately, again, you know, like just the way this sounded made, reminded me, Twin Peaks is coming back. So
coincidence?
I think May 2017, there's going to... If you were as much of a Twin Peaks head as I was when this aired, one chance out between two worlds, Fire Walk With Me, would have been meaningful, but as the poem that is recited at a certain point. But anyway, I'm in the Twin Peaks FAQ, actually. I saw a preview screening of Fire Walk With Me, I think, as I recall, and posted on Usenet and whatever. Not very interesting. So,
well, that's very neat. Any other Twin Peaks fans in the crowd? Well,
I
guess
never
not.
Seen it, but
about
I,
good coffee? Nah, I don't know.
But I'm now reading Paul's Usenet post from September 1st, 1992.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's a blast from the past. Carrington can relate to this. The other thing I'll say is, with 2017...
You don't know me. You don't know my life.
Oh, I bet I know this part. Came the taking down of my Doctor Who calendar, which made me sad.
I also had a Doctor Who calendar.
Not that I...
It was a gift. It was up in my kitchen all year.
Well, so was it the Doctor per month calendar? So all 12 Doctors?
Yes, it was.
Except for the War Doctor.
No, it wasn't. It was a per month thing, but it was just because it was a calendar. But no, it was just like a Doctor Who calendar.
Ah, yes. I had the Doctor of the Month, so that was pretty cool. I like my 2017 Vancouver, BC calendar. Very scenic. But it just, I'm missing my Doctor Who calendar, so there you
imagine go. Imagine it's like hidden doctors.
Yes, that's right. Where in the world
somewhere is the TARDIS?
Is Doctor, yeah. Ken, now it's your turn to save us, I think.
I got nothing, so I'm just going to close us out and pray for the best.
Way to go.
Yay. I think we've made our listeners endure enough, so that is it for this show. Thank you so much for listening to RCR episode number 145, recorded on Sunday, January 15th, 2017.
Dot, dot,
find
dot.
Find show notes for... Yes, dot, dot, dot. Find show notes for this episode and all episodes of RCR at our website, rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this episode and all episodes of RCR in the fora found at vcfed.org, VCFED, that's the Vintage Computer Federation. You can follow RCR on the Twitters at RCR Podcast. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, where you can find many other vintage and retro computing podcasts. You can also find a list of more podcasts at vintagesthenewold.com, which I'm mentioning because they just posted on January 9th, 2017, a roundup of all their favorite vintage computing podcasts. Thank you for including us and for including many of our other fine colleagues and contemporaries in this space. Finally, if you could take a moment, please write a review of the Retro Computing Roundtable at iTunes. It doesn't just stroke our egos, it also helps other retro computing enthusiasts find and discover our show on iTunes. Finally, to everybody who is out there and is loving retro computing all the way in the year 2017, to you, we offer the slogan, Retro Compute!